Why did I choose Psalm 23? Because it's about life and death. 50 years ago, Alan Chappell, my good mate, said, have you noticed the change of person between verse 3 and 4? The change of the grammar. The first three verses say, he. And the fourth verse says, you. And Alan said to me, that's significant. We drift through life. God is there, he's there, he's there, he's there. But when we face death, it becomes a relationship. You are there. And what a great frog story, wasn't that? Oh, how that awesome. I'm an old frog. Yeah, that's good.
Don't croak.
Oh, thank you. This is going to be a very flexible, chaotic discussion, I'm sure. If you don't match up with the slide, it doesn't matter. I get deviated. When I give talks to 60 medical students, I start off saying, are you going to die? And they'll go, yeah. Hang on, are you going to die? Yeah. Of course you are. But as I look at your faces, there's no emotion whatsoever. It means nothing to you. You don't really think about death. Tomorrow you are assigned to palliative care. You're going to a ward to meet a patient who's dying. If you say to her, are you going to die? She won't say, yeah. She'll start to cry because death is real. Our society does not face death. And that's what palliative care is all about. That's what euthanasia is all about. That's what the gospel is all about. Here's a photo I took about 15 years ago. It's on the top floor of Royal Perth Hospital. In the bed behind the purple dot is a 21-year-old man, a Christian lad. He's dying of leukemia. I was asked to see him to help him with terrible pain. He said, you can take the photo, but don't show my face because I think I'm ugly now. I choose him especially because when I give this to fourth-year medical students, how old are you? 21. He's 21 too. He's dying. Is this a good place to die? What an awful, awful thing. There's only one redeeming feature in that picture. Oh, where can you work? The music, that CD player was playing Amazing Grace. I thought, what? How perfectly appropriate the song is. But the environment is terrible. Nobody should. He died there about 3 days later. What do you think of this picture in contrast? This is another deathbed scene. What's the difference? This man is at home. He's in his own lounge room. He's in charge. He's at peace. His wife is there. I always thought those two hands almost touching looked like the Creation by Michelangelo. He's got a hospital bed. He's got nurses coming to his house. But he's in charge, he's dying at home. This was my father's death, age 93, 15 years ago. In the last week of his life, I slept in his bed at his house. I looked after him. And every day the relatives came, the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. Dying is about community, about family, about relationship. And even the frog had the little frogs comforting, accompanying him in his dying. No one should die alone. So, time for involvement. Think about this. If you could choose your death, would you rather opt for a sudden, unexpected death or a slow, predictable death? Think about it, and I want you to be brave and put up your hand. Who wants a fast death? Who wants a slow death? Well, that's about the same as I've done for 20 years. Two-thirds of people want a fast death. One-third want a slow death. Now, the exercise?
I want a slow death under certain conditions.
Ah. Fussy control freak. Now, I want you to get into pairs and discuss what's good about a fast death, what's good about a slow death, what's bad. Okay, you've got 2 minutes to talk. If you're desperate, you can be in a threesome, but twosome's best. Time's up. Time's up. It's a very a remarkable question. Every time I've done that, it's been very stimulating. People get involved. I first heard of it 25 years ago at a conference in Melbourne, when a professor of medicine from America asked 900 people, palliative care workers, if you could choose your own death, would you rather have a fast death or a slow death? And I thought, fast or slow, be nice to get it. No, I want to get ready. I want a slow death. And God said, oh, okay, I'll give you 15 years warning. We're all slow learners, aren't we? The Joint Select Committee on End-of-Life Care, End-of-Life Choices, was set up by the government about 18 months ago. I gave them this presentation, or part of it, I was sharing it with you. I said to these eight clever politicians, very powerful people, I said, in my private experience, one of the confusing things is food and fluids. If you're not eating, you can be fasting, or you can be voluntarily not eating. You can have a hunger strike. You can have starved to death. And each word's got a different meaning, different connotation. See the RPH process. Is he hungry or thirsty? I brought a few. Again, when I'm teaching doctors and medical students, I say, if I locked you in a room and threw away the key, how long would you survive with no food and no water? What do you reckon? 2 days? 2 weeks? 3 weeks? 4 weeks? 5 weeks? About a month, at least a month. No food, no water. And everyone looks shocked, that's not possible. If you're out in the Gibson Desert and your car breaks down, you start walking, you'll die in 2 days. But if you're lying quietly in a hospital bed or at home in an air-conditioned room, your body starts to live off fat, and fat turns into water, and you'll live for at least a month, possibly 2 months. If you're very, very plump, you might live 3 months with no food and no water. People misunderstand that, and they think, start in a fasting, I call it fasting. Fasting is actually a very pleasant way to die. It's more pleasant than suicide, assisted taking a pill. If you doubt that, I'll give you the reference in the New England Journal of Medicine. Andrew Denton, that well-known campaigner, lovely, brilliant entertainer, I love him, but he's hopeless about physiology. He says that the most shocking thing I learned was that Palliative Care Australia will accept a patient's right to hasten their own death by refusing food and fluids. Seared into my brain is the conversation. He's really hamming it up. It's totally wrong. I had dinner with Richard Chire, and I said, what was all that about with Andrew Denton? He said, the patient was dead, brain dead. There was no distress, no agitation. He's just laying it on thick. This is what we do when people are sick and dying and they can't eat and drink. We feed them artificially. It's a good idea, isn't it? I've skipped a couple of slides because they're a bit personal. This was a lady in Royal Perth who was dying, and she was being given 2 or 3 litres a day of milkshake stuff through a tube. Good, very sensible. But she didn't need it. Her body was blown up like a balloon. She had about 20 kilograms of extra water. Because the nurses and doctors said, well, if you can't eat and drink, you need to have 8 cups of water every day and milkshake and stuff. But not when you're dying. You don't. It's actually worse, makes life worse. There's great confusion about turning off the machine, stopping the ventilator. This is the most distressing thing I ever had to do as a doctor. Talk to a patient who says, I've had a good life, I'm dying, I've had enough, I don't like this machine on my face, this breathing machine, I want to take it off. I know if I take it off, firstly I'll get very breathless, secondly I'll die. Would you please give me a drug to put me to sleep first, then take the mask off and I'll die? The first time I was asked this, I said, I can't do that, that's killing you. And the patient said, well, do you mean I've got to wear this mask forever? So it took a long time to get, appreciate that it's legitimate to withdraw futile therapy. And this is a real patient in rural Perth who gave me permission to take this slide. He had advanced lung cancer. He was dying. He would probably die in a week or two. He was being kept alive on this breathing mask. And he said, I've had enough. I just want to take it off and die. I'm ready. There's no point going on. We talked to all the nurses, all the doctors, all the family, the relatives. They all said, yes, that's fine. So we gave him some sedation, turned off the machine. He died a couple of hours later. After about a year of meetings and reports and analysis, this government committee produced its report. It's 600 pages. I confess I didn't read every page. In fact, it's two reports. The first half is by seven of the politicians. The second half is by one dissenting voice. That's Nick Goyran. Nick Goyran is a very devout Christian. This working party on end-of-life choice is false. It's a fraud. It's set up by the government at great cost in order to get the conclusion that there should be euthanasia. They chose the politicians who would support it, and they had to choose Nick because he was helped setting it up. And it would be too obviously fraudulent if nobody opposed it. Nick's report is fantastic. It's 300 pages long. It's far more scholarly and accurate than the pro report. The report has 21 recommendations. The first dozen or so, the first few talk about advanced care planning. Very keen that everyone should write down, if I should be unconscious, dying of this, that, the other, don't do this to me, don't do this to me. And that's a good idea. The next eight or nine recommendations are about palliative care. Needs to be more of it, more people, more doctors, more hospices. The last recommendation is that the Minister for Health establish an expert panel, including health and legal practitioners and health consumers, to undertake a consultation and to develop legislation for voluntary assisted dying in Western Australia, and that this report, together with the framework contained at the end of Chapter 7, be considered by that panel. Recommendation that there be an expert panel to develop legislation for voluntary assisted dying. The first time I heard voluntary assisted dying, I thought, what's that? Voluntary assisted dying, that's what I do. I've done that with 30,000 patients. I've assisted them to die, and they've all been voluntary. But this is one of my deep objections to this whole process. It's euphemisms. Voluntary assisted dying is a doctor writing a prescription for a lethal dose, the patient getting it from the pharmacy and killing themselves. So I call it assisted suicide. If you're pro-euthanasia, you say, oh, it's not suicide, that's different, that's different sort of ill condition. No, this is a rational choice to end suffering. Well, my simple mind says if you take a fatal pill and it kills you, I call that suicide. This panel, this committee is given the task of addressing these issues. Eligibility. This is, of course, this is contentious, this is dangerous, so the committee is being very careful to say we have safeguards. You have to be terminally ill, chronically ill, neuro disease, where death is a reasonable foreseeable outcome. What's that mean? Reasonable foreseeable outcome. The Victorian legislation says you must die in 6 months. this committee said, that's too harsh, we'll make it no limit. Yeah. You qualify. Yeah, we'll give you the pill. Well, no, providing you're suffering. The person must be suffering, not temporary or able to be treated or remedied in a manner acceptable to the person. It's all very woolly. There's no way of proving this. The suffering must be related to an eligible condition. So you can say, I'm suffering every day with fear of diabetes and coma, and I have needles and I've got blood tests, I'm driving up the wall, I can't stand it. I say, you'll be okay. No, I can't stand it. You're a wimp. No, I'm suffering, I want to die. How can I say no? It must be grievous and irremediable. I mean, come off it, you're just pulling the leg. What's wrong with you? But there's no medical test for grievous and irremediable. It cannot be alleviated in a manner acceptable to the person. Well, you just take your insurance and you'll be fine. No, I don't want that. Well, you've got it. No, it's my choice. Oh, that's the first thing. What's the whole report called? My life, my choice. That's fascinating. That's modern Western civilization individualism. A psychologist would say that's early childhood stuff. I want an ice cream. I want my turn on the bike. Me, 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 me. It's immature. Maturity says, I'm part of the world. I'm connected to my family. I'm connected to my country. I'm connected to the earth. The interconnectedness of people and creation is part of wisdom. So I think this is quite almost humorous to say, my choice, my life, I want to die. You've got... It's not just my choice. You have to kill me because I want to. What about my choice to say, no, I don't want to be involved? The person must be aged 18 or over. Hey, I'm 17, I'm dying of cancer, why can't I have it? So we all know when this goes through, if this goes through, then within a year or so there'll be legal claims taken to the court. I'm denied justice because of on basis of age. I'm discriminated against. Must have capacity. Well, my father is dying of dementia and he can't say yes or no because he's demented. You mustn't discriminate on grounds of dementia. So that's a big fight. Now, I'm wondering if I can show this as a video. If it doesn't work, we just move on. But this is online. I think we're getting there. New Zealand faces the same challenge that we do in Australia. They are far ahead of us in their campaigning against euthanasia. There's a wonderful group called Care Alliance, I Care. They've got about 25 short video clips, 2 minutes each, interviewing people about their life and death. I love this one, this first one. She's a stunner. Claire Freeman. Now, I just hope we've got sound. That's a tricky one. The Joint Committee interviewed the Chief Psychiatrist of Western Australia. He said, every psychiatric association in the world says we don't want euthanasia for mental illness. It's too tricky. A lot of psychiatry treatment is trying to stop young people killing themselves, prevent suicide. So we say, you mustn't suicide, it's not good, but you're allowed to. In fact, we'll encourage you to. It's sending a double message. We got a soundtrack?
Accident. The car flipped, and as a consequence, I broke my neck. I'm classified as tetraplegic. I attempted suicide. I woke up in hospital. I'd been in a coma. And I just remember waking up just thinking, I can't believe this. Like, I was so angry because it hadn't worked. I remember going to see a psychiatrist and psychologist after my attempt. And they just said to me, look, if I had your disability, I wouldn't want to be here either. I would pursue assisted suicide, and that is something you should look at overseas. And at the time, I was like, yeah, thank you. You know, this is validation for the way I was feeling. If it had been available to me, if it had been an option here in New Zealand, I would have taken it, and I wouldn't be here. And in hindsight, knowing that is really scary, because I know that you can, you know, you can get out of that dark place if you address the issues. And I certainly wasn't addressing those issues. I didn't know how to address those issues. The assisted suicide bill, you know, includes disability as a criteria. Why target a really vulnerable group of people? It says something about the value that we place on those with disabilities. You know, what is it that we're saying to society and to those who do have a disability? That they're not of value? That you know, if they're having a bad time, that they should kill themselves? What does that say about us, about humanity? When I was in incredible pain and nothing would touch it, not even morphine, those moments, I didn't want to die, but I did want to die when I was depressed. So when I hear that it's about pain, it's not about pain, it's about suffering, and they're very different things, because suffering can be dealt with the right support. I'm Claire Freeman. I care.
When you get home this afternoon, if you're interested, you can just Google Care Alliance, one word, Care Alliance New Zealand. They've got these wonderful, powerful video clips. We could look at 10 more, but I want to move on. Back to PowerPoint. I just love the fact that anywhere I go, there's someone smart with technology. Oh, I'm too. This old frog won't catch up with the stuff. That looks good. Some of you may be a bit confused. What is palliative care? These are six defining statements by the WHO almost 30 years ago. Palliative care affirms life and regards dying as normal. But the second one is the important one. Neither hastens nor postpones death. Hastening death is suicide, euthanasia. Postponing death is dragging out the death in ICU with drips and machines. Does anybody remember Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel? At the age of about 80, he had a massive stroke. He was unconscious on a ventilator in ICU for 7 years because conservative Jewish theology says all life is super sacred and you must always prolong life no matter what. Christians believe life is sacred, but most Christians would say there's no point keeping a corpse alive. It's a time to stop. The Australian and New Zealand Society for Palliative Medicine, that is the palliative care specialists of ANZ, there are about 400 or 500 of us. 5 years ago, we put out a position statement, which I think is extremely good. It was done over a year, consulting every member, carefully worded, crafted by a lawyer. Number one, the palliative medicine discipline does not include the practice of euthanasia or assisted suicide. There's a clear distinction between good care for the dying and active interventions instituted in order to deliberately end the life of a patient. Two, patients have a right to refuse life-sustaining treatments. So you can refuse insulin, you can refuse anything. You can refuse artificial feeding, a face mask, operations. Refusing such treatment does not constitute euthanasia. There's a lot of confusion. The surveys say 80% of Australians want euthanasia. What were they asked? In the event that you're sick and dying and in great distress, should you be able to die peacefully? Of course. It should be 100% say yes to that. But This is not euthanasia. Withholding or withdrawing treatments that are not benefiting the patient is not euthanasia. Our young doctors are trained to fix, to fix, to fix, and they're good at it. But they have great trouble recognising that when someone's dying, and it's time to stop fixing. I think a huge amount of distress in dying is due to the doctor not saying time to stop, and the family not saying time to stop, because we're all scared of death and we pretend it's not there. The oncologists say, well, let's just try one more chemo. We've got this new stuff from New York that's got a 1% chance of working, so we give it a try. And the patient says, oh, the family say, we'd better do that. It's terrible. Treatment that is appropriately titrated to relieve symptoms and has a secondary and unintended consequence of hastening death is not euthanasia. This is called the principle of double effect, which has been around for hundreds of years. If someone's in great distress and they're dying, they're agitated, I'll give them a tranquilizer. If they're in pain, I'll give them a painkiller. And they might die the next week. If I give a dose of morphine and somebody dies, how do you know I'm trying to kill them or relieve their pain? There's a great deal of misunderstanding about morphine. It's a very good painkiller. It doesn't always work for pain. It's very good for breathlessness. Most people don't know that. It's brilliant. It gets inside the brain and says, do you feel gasping? Relax, you're not gasping anymore. Do you feel breathless? Not anymore. And the patient's relaxed. The oxygen doesn't change, the lungs don't change, but the brain changes and it feels more relaxed. So that's a very good use of morphine. Palliative sedation for the management of refractory symptoms is not euthanasia. This is an absolutely crucial one. Refractory symptoms means the patient says, I'm in pain, I'm vomiting, I've got constipation, I've got cough, whatever, and they won't get better. And I say, I can't fix them anymore. The patient might say, I know I'm dying next week. This is awful. This is suffering extreme. Just let me die quicker. I say, I don't want to kill you, but I'll give you whatever you need to make you peaceful. And if that makes you so sleepy that you can't talk or even unconscious, it's okay by me. Is that what you want? And being practical, people might say, well, my daughter's coming from Canada tomorrow. I want to be wide awake and talk to her, and then I'm happy to go. People have amazing ability to rise to the occasion. So the problem of suffering and evil is just bound up with this whole notion of euthanasia. My life, my choice says, I am a free agent, I'm mature, I can choose, I do not want any suffering. That's modern society. Anyone know who this is? Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Anyone ever heard of him? Medical students never have. He's a famous Russian author, Nobel Prize winner for literature, who wrote documents criticising the communist government of Russia. That's not a good thing to do. He spent decades in prison camps. Soviet prisoners in the Siberian Gulag. After decades of imprisonment, he says, prison causes the profound rebirth of a human being. Your soul, which was dry, ripens through suffering. Your soul, which was dry, ripens through suffering. That sounds a bit crazy, doesn't it? This man should say, I hate their guts, they're awful, I'm going to punch them all. He said, no, prison was good for me. That is why I turn back to the years of my imprisonment and say, sometimes to the astonishment of those about me, bless you, prison. Wow. I run 2-day workshops for doctors on suffering and healing. And this is the question from this statement is, have you been through some terrible trauma in your life, something really devastating, but you've been healed, you've got over it, You're now able to say, bless you, prison, or bless you, divorce, or bless you, Parkinson's disease, or bless you, something else. I did one workshop. That's the time. I'm liable to deviate into stories. Insights from the death of Jacob. This is the most wonderful death. Jacob called for his sons and said, gather together so I can tell you what will happen to you in the future. And if you read the whole chapter, he starts with Reuben, he goes to the 12 sons. Then he instructed them, I'm about to go to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron. When Jacob finished giving these instructions to his sons, he pulled his feet up onto the bed, breathed his last breath, and went to his people. That's a fantastic death. He's at home, in bed. You just see the old man, he's 147 years old, I think. He pulls up his feet, like the old frog, he just fades away. He doesn't die. He breathes his last breath. He's in charge. There's no fear. He's complete. And he went to his people. What's that mean? He went to the next world and he met Abraham and Isaac, his grandfather and his father. Modern culture says there's no such thing as life after death. So this has no meaning. Well, surely this is the most important thing in all of our lives. If this 70 years on earth is merely a brief stay on in mortality, and we're going to move to immortality, shouldn't we prepare for the next life? This is my hero, Balfour Mount. He was a brilliant urological surgeon in Canada. He did a Christian. He did a survey of the hospital about dying, and he found out that people died horrible deaths in the McGill Royal Victoria Hospital. So he went to London and met Dame Cicely Saunders. He introduced palliative care to Canada. And he says, healing is a relational process involving movement towards an experience of integrity and wholeness. It may be facilitated by caregiver's interventions, but it's dependent on an innate potential in the patient. It is not dependent on the presence of or the capacity for physical healing. It is possible to die healed. In other words, you don't have to have your cancer cured. You don't have to get over your Parkinson's disease. You'll die. But you can die healed. I read that when it was first published 16 years ago and I thought, oops, misprint. Die healed. No, that doesn't make sense. But it does. My earthly father, Jack Bridge, died healed. He was remarkably at peace with all his family, with his life. Oops, I skipped one. This is my favourite cartoon, the Looney cartoon. If we had some more time, I'd say discuss this for 5 minutes. To me, it says, this is us at some stage in our life. We all get crushed by devastating stuff. And when you're there, you feel like life's not worth living and you'll never get better again. But if you can endure with patience and overcome your grief, then the burden becomes a platform on which you stand. Lindy has got fantastic cartoons. My wife brought home a book from the market, so she buys stuff for $3. I thought you might like this. It's 400 Looney cartoons. Wonderful. I picked out 15, the best, and I put them on slides. Then I felt good. What about copyright? Well, I Googled Lennick, and he says, you are welcome to use any of my slides for teaching with no copyright. There's no copyright. Just please write down image courtesy of Michael Lennick. What a lovely man. And that's, I think, the most profound slide. I'd like to finish with this 4 or 5 minute video clip, if that's possible. It's Balfour Mount talking to a patient a lady with advanced ovarian cancer who's dying. She's suffering, and I use this to talk about listening, the skill of listening to a patient. Instead of saying, "You're dying, we'll give you a dose of a fatal injection," the listening is healing. I don't need to help them, they're better than me. That's it, wonderful.
Not only was it a diagnosis of cancer, I was in stage 4. My prognosis was 6 months. However, I consented to chemo, which gave me about 25% chance of survival. And they decided on very heavy-duty chemo. My world collapsed. I was going to die. I didn't think that I would survive it. I spoke to somebody when I was in a crisis, and she suggested that she would call Dr. Bal, and he would see me for consultation one time. I think what we'll do is I was totally depleted. I didn't think I could carry on with any more chemo. I went to see him, and 3 hours later, after he talking to him, and he validated me as a person and made me feel very comfortable.
I'm seeing who has advanced cancer, who frequently is experiencing very severe symptoms. And if she's upset or anxious or anguished, her symptoms are out of control. And by the time we've been talking and chatting and I've been listening and we've been interacting and mm-hmm. I've been learning from her, she says, "You know, it's just the strangest thing. That headache is gone. And my fingers, my legs don't pain anymore."
And that went on for 2 years where a lot of healing took place. A lot of feelings around how I felt about myself. I always felt that I wasn't good enough or smart enough. And he helped me through it. I read Frankl's book, Search for Meaning, 3 times, I think, in my life. And I really could relate. When I read the book again now, I picked out a few phrases. I think Nietzsche said, "He who has a will to live can bear almost anyhow." And I could relate to that. I probably had a will to live. That's why I was able to go on.
Isn't that amazing? That's my role model, my hero. I met him once for 2 minutes and I shook his hand. We've been collaborating for the last 10 years. The power of listening. He says, "We'd been listening, I've been learning from her." What a gracious thing to say. And she says, after 3 hours, wow, what a session that would have been. Amazing. And she said, "It's the strangest thing. My headache's gone, my pain's gone." This is almost miraculous stuff. This is astonishing. But it's not a miracle in my definition of miracles. It's the result of love, of compassion, of support. And that's in short supply often. It's time to stop. I can chat for hours. I think we've had a pretty good run. I'm in your hands.